is cruelty as policy. This is an obscenity. This is the government of the United States and the president that we both love advocating a system by which young children are torn from their mothers.
Geraldo, Sean, you have agreed with me.
History will judge us, Sean. History will judge us. We must take a stand on something. We cannot condone this. The Republicans are the party of faith and family.
Nobody condones it. That's the point.
When do we become the party of child
emergency session?
So who are you on the other side of this microphone? Who are you? Do you know where you're going to be when history looks back on this particular event? It's one of the things I'd like to highlight today. Over at the Fox News Channel, as you heard there with Hannity and Geraldo, they believe that, well, at least Hannity believes that romance appears to be dead. Hannity, when it comes to Hannity, there's no level of evil that he will not defend. I followed Sean Hannity's career since he went on radio in 2001, studied him when I was in broadcasting school. I listened to his show to this day, not all 3 hours. When I first started listening to talk radio, I used to listen to all 3 hours, and I learned something. Sean Hannity comes to the microphone. He does a three-hour radio show, and then he does a one-hour television show at night. This right-wing propaganda is super-duper important to him. He comes to the microphone with about 10 minutes worth of material for a three-hour show. When you have a radio show, and I don't design mine this way, obviously. I don't have a standard radio show. I don't have commercials and all the rest. But you rotate people in and out about every 20 minutes or so. So with that said, it's a good idea to sometimes repeat or say, so as we were talking about in the last hour, so on and so forth, just to sort of catch people up, because rarely anybody listens to all 3 hours. So when I listen to Sean Hannity's show for all 3 hours, I notice he really just repeats the exact same stuff over and over again. And my father, who is a diehard Hannity fan, he'll catch his show in the evening, but he doesn't listen to his show during the day, or if he does, he only listens to a segment of it, because he just repeats himself. Over and over, the same things over and over again, the same talking points over and over again, just really drilling them in. Nobody is better at propaganda than is Sean Hannity. When we look back at the history of this, it's not just going to be the baby jails that are embarrassing. It's going to be the absolute loss of humanity that we are suffering, it's not a loss, we are surrendering our humanity here in the United States. Now, since our inception, the United States has never really been an honest broker, never really been the beacon of freedom. We've had these shining moments, that's for sure. World War II and so forth. But for the most part, we took this country by force, by rape, by murder. And then we've maintained it as such through acts of terror like slavery. So the history of the United States is checkered at best. But we're at this point now where we're not even pretending that America is this great and wonderful thing. You know, the shining city on the hill, pick your talking point. We're not even pretending now. We've pulled out of the human rights group that's in the United Nations. We said, they're not worthy of their name. That's what we said. They're not worthy of their name. Well, I suppose if that's the case, the United States is also not worthy of its name because we are clearly not united. I read a story recently about Nevada, which, red state, wants to have the death penalty. But of course, the drugs that they want to use to carry out the death penalty, well, the companies that make them, they don't want to sell them to the states anymore. Because they said, we don't want our drugs to be used to kill people. So what is a right-wing state to do when they want to kill prisoners, but they can't get the drugs they need to kill prisoners? In case you haven't noticed lately, there's an awful lot of people dying from a legal drug that is available to just about everybody and anybody. You go in and you say that you're in some pain. You suffered a recent accident of sorts. And they will give you very, very likely an opioid. And the opioid's going to work. It's going to take away your pain. That's for damn sure. But there's something that happens with opioids. It's not just that they take away your pain. They begin to take over your brain. I listened to a TED Talk recently where a gentleman talked about an accident that he had been through. And he said that he was given opioids post-accident. And they ramped him up to a level to where he was comfortable and feeling no more pain. He went into the doctor just to get checked, just to get his injury checked out. And the doctor says, hey, how much are you taking right now? The opioids. And he mentioned how many he was taking. And the doctor goes, whoa, we need to start pulling you back. So here's the thing. Doctors are very good at prescribing these things. But if you call most, the vast majority of doctor's offices, and you ask how to get off of the opioids, a lot of these offices will tell you they don't do that. They don't do tapering, and they don't deal with withdrawals. Their job, when it comes to the pharmaceutical companies, their job is to get you on these things, and that's it. Get you to buy these things so that it can make the legal drug dealers in America rich, and that's it. So, with that said, he said, well, how hard could it be to get off of this drug? He went home, and he started tapering down. But he didn't know how much to taper, so he tapered about a quarter. And horrible sweats, and cold, and can't sleep, and nightmares, and depression just set in, and beat the piss out of him for about a week. And he said, okay, all right, the worst part of it has got to be over. Into week two. Pulls back a little bit more. Now he's down to about half a dose. And it hit him even harder. I'm obviously doing the shortened version of this. You can listen to the entire TED Talk, and it's the withdrawal from opioids. More sweats, more nightmares, can't sleep, depression settling in, thoughts of suicide. Holy hell, it's only been 2 weeks. Thoughts of suicide are beginning to settle in. And then they hit week three, and they go see more doctors, and the doctors go, no. We prescribe the drugs. That is what we are paid to do. We're paid to take your pain away. We prescribe the drugs. We do not help you get off the drugs. It's not our job. He realized that there are some places that can help him do that, but they're out of state. They're not in the state that he lives in. And they're generally not covered by insurance. So towards the end of week three, it really starts getting bad. His thoughts of suicide are really starting to take hold. And he's starting to feel like he's never, ever going to be normal again. He's just thinking about ending it all. And when things seem like they can't get any worse, they don't. And about week four, he finally finds his way out of it. The research that he's done since then, so it took him 3.5 weeks to get off of these drugs, to get over the opioid withdrawals, which were just horrible. So many times he thought about going back on the opioids. That was actually what the doctor suggested. They go, hey, just go back on the drug. And he goes, but if I go back, I'm never going to get off the drug. But he says, I can't take the withdrawals anymore. So what he learned after he got off of the opioids is when you're tapering, you're not supposed to taper any more than 10% a week. The withdrawals. If you taper faster than that, the withdrawals, meaning you getting off of this drug, can kill you. So if you take too much of an opioid, it can kill you. If you become dependent on opioids, they can back you up. You can get constipated. There are now drugs that you can buy that will help you deal with your opioid-induced constipation. This is where we're at, ladies and gentlemen. And we're not here because it's helping us. We're not here because it's brilliant. We're not here because it's a good idea. We're here because it makes somebody a lot of money. So think about that. A drug that will kill you if you take too much of it, that's not that strange, but will kill you if you try to come off of it. And the people that prescribe it to you, they're not there to help you get off that drug. So with that said, as dangerous as opioids are, the state of Nevada, which wanted to kill somebody recently, said, hey, what is that drug that is killing lots and lots of people? Maybe we should use that. And it looked like the state was about to go forward with it. But then they had to pull back. They said, no, it's not legal. You cannot use opioids to kill a prisoner. But opioids are such an effective killing tool that the state was and is still, they're just waiting on a court decision, and is still considering using it to kill people. And this is prescribed to so many people right now. I was on a drug once. I was put on an antidepressant for my headaches. I used to have these really bad headaches. And I did not, first of all, it did not take care of the pain. And second of all, I didn't like the side effects that came along with the drug. So one day, I decided, that's it. I don't need the drug. I'm just going to stop taking it. And then I did. And my head just started spinning. This is just an antidepressant. This isn't even an opioid. And I started getting sick. And I started getting depressed. Horrible, horrible things. Nightmares just out of control. Holy shit. Okay, so I went back on the drug. And I went to the doctor and go, Doc, I need off of this drug. Oh, okay, well, we'll give you this drug. You're going to give me another drug. Well, you can't just quit taking that drug. And I go, but I did. And he goes, oh, no, you can't do that. Wow, Doc. So you gave me a drug that was useless, that didn't do what it was supposed to do, and now I can't get off of it. It took me about 2 or 3 months of taking another drug, and then another drug, and then another drug in order to taper. So I was lucky, I suppose, because the doctors were willing to work with me to help me taper. But why are you giving us these poisons? The president is screaming right now about Mexicans coming over the border and bringing drugs and bringing crime and bringing rape or whatever. But we seem to be overlooking the fact that the drug dealers, they're not the Mexicans coming over the border. You know, it's not the African Americans that live in your neighborhood. These are the pictures that we're always shown when it comes to drug dealers, these people with brown skin. What it should be showing is men in suits, men like Alex Azar, the head of Health and Human Services, who used to work for Eli Lilly, who is now largely responsible for the baby jails in America. Yeah, that guy. That guy is in charge of Health and Human Services. And he's a former head of a drug company. These are your drug dealers. Drug dealers should be these white men in suits. It should also be the white men in white coats. Those are your drug dealers. Excuse me, Mr. President. Are you going to begin deporting those guys? Because they're white. And they wear suits. My guess is that you're not.
In the United States, I'm deeply concerned by recently adopted policies which punish children for their parents' actions. In the past 6 weeks, nearly 2,000 children have been forcibly separated from their parents. I call on the United States to immediately end the practice of forcible separation of these children. People do not lose their human rights by virtue of crossing a border without a visa.
That's the chief of human rights at the United Nations. Quoting here, the United States announced it was leaving the United Nations Human Rights Council with Ambassador Nikki Haley calling it an organization that is not worthy of its name. It was the latest withdrawal by the administration from an international institution. Haley, the president's envoy to the UN, said the U.S. has given the human rights body opportunity after opportunity to make changes. She lambasted the council for its chronic bias against Israel and lamented the fact that its membership includes accused human rights abusers such as China, Cuba, Venezuela, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Hold on. If we want those countries, Nikki Haley, if we want those countries to start acting better, then yeah, they need to be a part of that council because they need to learn. The real reason that the United States is leaving the Human Rights Council is because we, as Americans, no longer collectively believe in human rights. Yeah, there are protests against the baby jails. Yes, there are people screaming that you should reunite the kids with their parents. Yes, but words, they're just words. They don't do anything. And I'm not sure if anyone's noticed, but this particular administration, really anybody that works for him, they don't care what you say. They're going to do whatever the hell they want to do. So when asked recently how we can deal with the children coming across the border, the president said, hey, they just need to come across legally. Just come across legally. Don't come across illegally. Come across legally. The vast majority of these folks coming over the border with their children are seeking asylum. And by the way, seeking asylum is legal. L-E-G-A-L, legal. 100% legal. And he said, well, don't just come over our border. Why don't you apply for asylum from home? First of all, as we covered in last week's show, they're about to be effing killed by the gangs in their country. And so they get out of there so that they don't get effing killed. And we said, no. Apply from home. Here's the thing about asylum, and this is written in our laws. You have to apply for asylum in person. Oh, by the way, and it's legal. So why are they freaking out about the brown folks coming over the border? Let me tell you like this. There's about a 90-95% resettlement rate right now for Europeans coming into America. If you are European, if you are white, you are being settled in America at a pretty alarming rate. And by the way, nobody's hearing about that. Nobody's hearing about the white people coming to America because that's okay. MAGA is really just make America white again. But the folks coming over the border, well, they're brown. And even though they're doing what they're supposed to, in order to get asylum, you have to come here in person. And it's legal to apply for asylum. But our current administration has made that illegal. Zero tolerance for trying to follow the law. They are following the law. What's happening on the border is really nothing more than white supremacy as official policy.
This is white nationalism. It's not about being a bigot. It's not about I don't like you here. This president and his administration have explicitly said we want to change the demographic future of this country. We want to keep brown people out. We want to have the brown people who are here afraid or terrorized or wanting to go home. We want to limit where people can come from. 87% of our refugee resettlements from Europe have already been done this year.
Right.
We're 6 months in and 87% of Europeans have already been resettled here. But somehow it's a problem when you have asylum seekers at the border who are trying to, who've traveled 10,000 miles through dangers, some of which were caused by our administration. If you look at the coup in Honduras.
There we go. 87%. No problem. 87%. And although there are a fair amount of my countrymen who at least appear to be outraged, I'm going to have to say that for the most part, I don't believe it. Yeah, you listening, I'm sure you're outraged. And with me, there's almost 300 episodes of this show to show how outraged I am at the level of racism that exists in America. But for the most part, I still don't believe that there's a lot of people that are willing to do anything about it. When I watched a recent hearing with Peter Strzok on Capitol Hill, I saw McCarthyism is what I saw. I saw the most embarrassing GOP legislators screaming at Peter Strzok, trying to make him the boogeyman and blame him for everything. Just absolute upside down and inside out outright scumbags, just wasting your time and your money and not doing your work. But guess what? Those scumbags that were leading that hearing, they're very likely to all get back into office next year. Yeah, they're not doing work for you. They do not represent you. But it is so likely that they're just going to walk right back in there. We hear so much of the phrase, the new normal. And none of us wants to think that this is going to keep happening. None of us wants to think that, yeah, this is the new normal. But it seems, unfortunately, that it is. Because I cannot get my countrymen to act. Article here from The Guardian. The headline, rapist, animals, and drug dealers. Woman abuses Latino man in an echo of Trump. A Latino man who was filmed being racially abused by a white California woman has had similar incidents. Similar incidents have become increasingly regular since Trump took office. I know, I said dum-dum's name. Video of Esteban Guzman being verbally attacked by the unidentified woman has been watched more than 3 million times since it was shared recently. The footage shows a woman putting her finger in Guzman's face. "Why do you hate us?" Guzman asks. "Because you're Mexicans," the woman replies. Guzman tells her, "But we're honest people." And she says, "Yeah, rapists and animals and drug dealers." She's using Trump's exact language. The things that he's saying are leading to more and more hate crimes. There was a video recently of a woman wearing a Puerto Rico shirt. Okay, by the way, that's a U.S. territory. And some slack-jawed yoga, "Dang, why are you wearing that? This is America. Don't you know that this is America?" Yeah, stupid. Puerto Rico is also America. It's a U.S. territory. But talking about that dang old. The problem was she was brown. And that's all this is. Every single policy that is coming out of D.C. right now that I can't seem to get people to give a about. It's white nationalism. It's horrible racism. And it's almost impossible to get people to care. Still waiting on that blue wave, but not fully expecting it to happen. So to this. There are some Republicans speaking out. Yeah. Good for them. Bless their hearts. There are some Republicans speaking out. But their numbers are small. And when they do speak out, they generally get a whole lot of backlash. And maybe they don't get backlash from the entire GOP. But the ones they do get the backlash from, they tend to hammer on them. Senator John McCain, who, by the way, was a presidential candidate twice, and Republicans enthusiastically voted for him, now call him a turncoat and all kinds of other things because he's not okay with racism. He's not okay with fascism. So look around. Look at yourself, your friends, your family. I remember reading about these points in history. I remember reading about the Nazis. I remember reading about the internment camps in America and going, if I were alive during that time, I would not have been okay with that. I would have not bought into the propaganda. Basic human rights says, we're not going to do that. We're not going to believe in that. We're not going to condone that. We're not going to stand by while that happens. Well, ladies and gentlemen, here it is. And it's happening now. And it's happening during your lifetime. Yeah, it's not the Nazis yet. It's not the internment camps yet. But a Muslim ban was recently upheld by the Supreme Court. And the Muslim ban had nothing to do with anything other than stopping brown people from coming into this country. So yeah, it's not those horrible points in history yet. But it could be before long. And what are you going
to
do?
Can't wait to hear what the answer is. What are you going to do in this time of crisis where 2,300 babies are being incarcerated by Donald Trump's centralized state? What is your response to that moral and ethical question that has a bearing on not only how the rest of the world sees the United States of America, the country that has fed and freed more people than any other country in the history of this planet? What are you going to do today?
It's nice to hear Mr. Scarborough speaking out like that. He's one of the few Republicans that are doing it, and he's saying, hey, just like I'm saying to you, look around. Are you happy with the world you're in? Look around. Are you ready to behave? You ready to continue just going along with this? The headline, a jogger accidentally crossed into the U.S. from Canada and was detained for 2 weeks. We are so afraid of people coming into our borders. A jogger running along the border, which, by the way, depending on where you're at the border, is absolutely beautiful. I run, and I love running, and I love finding fun places to run. This probably could have happened to me. Well, I got a slight tint to my skin. Not full brown, but a slight tint. So, I don't know. I guess just going anywhere near the border, I could end up in one of these, baby jails. Whatever. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to take a look at ourselves. A serious, serious look at ourselves. Is this who we are? Are we anti-human rights? Are we pro-baby jail? Yeah, it's not the Nazis in internment camps yet. But those countries didn't wake up one day and say, let's have internment camps. Let's have Nazis. Let's murder Jews. That didn't happen in a day. It happened over time. And more people tolerated, the more and more they got dealt. Until eventually they look back and they go, what the hell happened? How are we murdering Jews now? What the...
presents a story of opportunity, a new story, a new beginning, one of peace, two men, two leaders, one destiny. Will this leader choose to advance his country and be part of a new world, be the hero of his people? Will he shake the hand of peace? Featuring President Donald Trump and Chairman Kim Jong-un in a meeting to remake history.
That was the audio from part of a North Korea-style propaganda video that was put out by, ladies and gentlemen, you paid for that, your White House. Yeah, you paid for that. That movie trailer for the meeting between one Donald Trump and leader Kim Jong-un. Yeah, you paid for that. Just build as this gigantic boom, boom, explosions, car crashes, naked ladies. It was ridiculous. And what we've learned since then is that this meeting yielded absolutely nothing. Kim Jong-un said recently that America was acting in gangsterish. You're acting like, why are you asking us to get rid of our nuclear weapons? Huh? You cannot ask us to get rid of our nuclear weapons. And Trump said, whoa, 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 wait a minute. I shook your hand. No response. So then our Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, goes there. And Mike Pompeo says, hey, the whole denuclearization thing. Oh, by the way, Mike was only able to meet with people that were a part of Kim's government. Kim would not meet with him again. See, Kim got everything that he needs. There was never a plan to denuclearize. You ask a conservative, and if you don't want to talk to a conservative, and I understand if you don't, you really should, but if you don't, just go to one of their Facebook pages. Oh, just punch in the word snowflake or punch in the N-word. Just do a search on Facebook. And those key words will come up, obviously, in posts. You go to the profile connected with those posts, and you'll see conservatives screaming fake news about the fact that Kim Jong-un is not going to denuclearize. All the reports that say that he's not going to denuclearize, he has no idea what America is talking about with this denuclearization. So embarrassing. Could the thing with North Korea have gone any more wrong? So this week, we were supposed to meet to collect the remains of those dead soldiers. We picked a time. We picked a place. American representatives were there. And the Kim government did not show up with the dead bodies. Kim got everything out of this meeting. We were promised dead bodies. And we didn't get the dead bodies. So it's like you gave $1 million to this guy. And this all this guy had to do was shake your hand. He's never even heard of you. He's just going to keep your $1 million. But yet, Trump doesn't seem to be deterred at all. On Monday, he's going to meet with another head of state, this time Vladimir Putin. Imagine Vladimir Putin is in for a handy jibber. I expect the meeting to also go not all that well. And I expect Trump to give him everything that he wants. He already has. Let's talk NATO. So NATO's probably not on most people's radar. It runs in the background, effectively. I'm using computer terminology, I suppose, or phone terminology. It runs in the background. It does these great and wonderful things. You don't have to think about it. It just happens. So after World War II, we decided to put together this group of countries so as to make sure that we don't have another world war. The biggest reason that it was set up was because the USSR was a problem. And so we put together NATO, and it's these 10 countries. And the idea is that an attack on one of us is an attack on all of us. It was to make sure that there was never another world war, and it was to make sure that we dealt with Russia effectively, the USSR, effectively. Putin believes that the fall of the USSR, the United Socialist Republic, the United Soviet Socialist Republic, is the worst thing that ever happened. And Putin really wants to bring back the USSR. Oh, by the way, he'd also like to start annexing more countries. We've never had a problem with NATO. We just went there, we did our thing, you know, and with NATO, there's a thing called Article 5. And Article 5 is the part of NATO that says an attack on one of us is an attack on all of us. And if your country is attacked, then you simply cite Article 5 and, you know, other countries kick into gear and fight for you. Article 5 has been implemented once, just once, post 9/11. It was after we were attacked. Other NATO countries decided to send their soldiers to our wars to fight and die for us because we're the only ones who have effectively benefited in a serious fashion from being a part of NATO. But Putin doesn't like NATO. He would like NATO to not be around. He doesn't want anyone telling him that the USSR or the idea of the USSR is dangerous and that it shouldn't be. He doesn't want anyone telling him that he cannot invade and annex countries. He does not want to hear that. So he would very much like to get rid of NATO. Trump this last week went there and did the dirty work for Putin. Just trashed NATO upside down and inside out. Got up there and complained that nobody's paying their fair share. Nobody. We're defending everybody and they're not paying us for it. All right. So it's not just 10 countries anymore. There's quite a few countries that are a part of NATO now. And the idea with NATO is that you need to spend 2% of your country's GDP, 2% on defense. There's not a big pot of NATO money. The president's lying when he says that people aren't paying their fair share. They're not paying their way. He's just spreading Putin's talking points for him. But the idea is that they got to spend 2% of their GDP on their national defense, on their military. And a lot of them are. And those that are not are very close. But they don't have to do that. They just have to meet that expectation by 2024, 6 years away. We don't know what it's going to look like by then. But Dum Dum decided to go there and scream about how nobody's paying their fair share right now. A lot of them are. And those that aren't are very close. So why is he out there freaking out and panicking about this? We fully expected him to pull out of NATO because that's what Putin wants. He didn't pull out of NATO this year. But I expect that if he remains as president, he might pull out next year or the year after. Remember, we're the only ones that have benefited from NATO. It's there for the benefit of all of us, kind of like an insurance policy, but we're the only ones who have collected on that insurance. And we're screaming about how other people aren't doing their part, aren't paying their fair share. Why are we doing that? Donald Trump doesn't know what NATO is. He probably only recently learned what it was after meeting with Putin. But the fact that he's got his panties in a wad about NATO tells me one thing. It's just one more thing that he's doing for Vladimir Putin. And I imagine that this meeting that he's going to have on Monday, by the time this show comes out, is nothing more than saying, Putin, am I a good boy? Am I doing your work for you, Daddy? Do you love me, Daddy? It's not going to be a meeting there. It's not going to ask him about collusion. So I love the fact that Robert Mueller came out on Friday with another dozen indictments against Russians just ahead of his meeting with Putin. So with that happening, one would say, you know what? Probably not a good idea to meet with Putin right now because it's pretty clear because the 12 guys that were indicted were from the GRU, the Russian intelligence. With that, it's probably not a real good idea that you go and meet with Pooty Poot, huh? But Trump will not be deterred. He's going to go meet with him. He's going to give him a big wet kiss on the mouth. And what for? Is it for money? Or is it because he simply loves dictators? I think that I can make a case for both.
He's the head of a country, and I mean, he's the strong head. Mm-hmm. Don't let anyone think anything different. Right. He speaks and his people sit up at attention. I want my people to do the right. Same.
So Trump has a thing for dictators. Trump himself wants to be a dictator. And in North Korea, they kill independent journalists. In Russia, they kill journalists. There was a recent shooting at a newspaper, and Trump refused for a long time to decry the murder of the people at that newspaper. Why? Because he's cool with it. He's cool with the murder of journalists. And this isn't a new thing. So Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski from MSNBC have been interviewing Trump for a long time. He appeared on Joe's show just like he appears on Fox all the time. And several years ago, he was being questioned. Joe and Mika were having sort of a loose, fun interview with him. And they said, hey, the murder of journalists, bad, right? And he goes, whatever. Whoa. Wait a minute. What?
Do you like Vladimir Putin's comments about you?
Sure. When people call you brilliant, that's always good, especially when the person heads up Russia.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, also it's a person that kills journalists, political opponents,
and invades countries.
Obviously, it would be a concern, would it not?
He's running his country, and at least he's a leader, you know, unlike what we have in this country.
No, but again, he kills journalists that don't agree with him.
Well, I think our country does plenty of killing also, Joe. So, you know, there's a lot of stupidity going on in the world right now, Joe. A lot of killing going on, a lot of stupidity. And that's the way it is. But you didn't ask me the question. You asked me a different question. So that's fine.
I'm confused. So, I mean, you obviously condemn Vladimir Putin killing journalists and political opponents, right?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. That thing you said, whatever that is. Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I'm with that. Now, a scary ass territory that we're going into when you have somebody that refuses to say that it's wrong to murder journalists. And by the way, this fake news, it's the fact that he screams out fake news all the time, the world's dictators are now beginning to use this. Whenever there's bad press about them, they simply say fake news. They're beginning to use his phrasing, make such and such country great again. Make Russia great again, make Turkey great again. Cool with it. Dictators just all banding together right now before our very eyes. What Trump wants, like all good dictators, is state-run media. It's effectively what Fox News is right now. They're only doing the bidding of Donald Trump. Whatever he says, whatever they want people to believe he said, whatever they want people to believe that he does, only the news that he wants covered do they cover. And dictatorships love state-run media. North Korea has it. Of course, Russia has it. China has it. They love, and Xi Jinping from China is now president for life. And the way they hold on to that power is through state-run media. The prime minister of Italy, Berlusconi, this was how he became prime minister. He bought some media, made some money, bought some more media, made some money, and then when he owned 90% of the country's media, ran for prime minister and won. The media is a very powerful tool. That's why a lot of conservatives hate it. That's why dictators hate it, because it's very powerful. And now looking at the power that the media has and what the media can do for an aspiring dictator, Trump is looking at our media and wondering what it would look like to have Trump TV all the time. Only the things he wants you to hear and when he wants you to hear them, from who he wants you to hear them from.
They only have state-run TV in North Korea, and the president, by all accounts, was kind of struck by that. He could see that this state-run TV anchor was lavishing praise on Kim, and he kind of liked that. Now, he was maybe joking in when he said she should come and work for Fox and get a job in the U.S., but there is sort of a grain to truth that the president, as we know, likes fawning news coverage. That's no secret, and that's why he goes on Fox, and that's why he watches Fox, and that was something he sort of admired in the North Korean society.
Mr. President, the joint statement does not talk about verifiable or irreversible denuclearization.
Yeah.
Is that a concession on the part of the United States?
No, not at all, because if you look at it, I mean, it said we are going to, let's say here, it will be gone. I don't think you can be any more plain than what we're asking. Issues related to the establishment of the new U.S. DPKR relations, the building. We talk about the guarantees, and we talk about unwavering commitment to the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. This is the document that we just signed.
He's not even familiar with the document that he signed. He has to look at it. He has to read it. And actually, it could have been more plain. See, there was no timetable, and it was not really binding, and there were no other countries involved in it, and it was a terrible deal. But it's fine. When it comes to dictators, when it comes to the children on the border, when it comes to any of this stuff, the reason that we do it, the reason Trump wants so much power is because money and power. The opioid crisis. I can't pronounce a stupid word. Why do we have the opioid? Man, listen to me go. I'm not even going to edit that out. Look at the opioid crisis. Why do we have the opioid crisis? Money, power. All right? The drug companies have a lot of power and they're making tons of money. The doctors are making money. Okay? Why do we have the kids, the baby jails on the border? Once again, ladies and gentlemen, money, and power. President looks powerful putting babies in jail. But money. Don't forget about that. There's also an awful lot of money in this. This from AP. Detaining immigrant kids is now a billion-dollar industry. So it's twofold. One, he gets to look like an absolute Nazi to his supporters, and they love that. But he also gets to make money for all of his rich white friends. Quoting here, detaining immigrant children has morphed into a surging industry in the U.S. and now reaps $1 billion annually. That's a tenfold increase over the past decade, according to the Associated Press. Health and Human Services grants for shelters, foster care, and other child welfare services are detained for detained unaccompanied and separated children soared from $74.5 million in 2007 to $958 million in 2017. The agency is also reviewing a new round of proposals amid a growing effort by the White House to keep immigrant children in government custody. Currently, more than 11,800 children are in children concentration camps. are in these detention centers from a few months to 17 years old and are housed in nearly 90 facilities in 15 states, Arizona, California, Connecticut, Florida, Illinois, Kansas, Maryland, Michigan, New Jersey, New York, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Texas, Virginia, and Washington. That last one breaks my heart. Washington. Why? Why, oh, why? Why do we have baby jails in Washington? So the president says, we need these baby jails because we need to save money. The immigrants are coming in. They're taking your jobs. Taking your jobs, taking your freedom, sell you drugs or rape your wife. So if it's supposed to save us tons of money to kick out all the immigrants, save the jobs by kicking out all the brown folk, why the hell is this costing so much money? Quoting here, Donald Trump says the cracking down on immigration will ultimately lead to spending less money and having fewer immigrants in government custody. Quoting here, illegal immigration costs our country hundreds of billions of dollars, he recently said at a rally. So imagine if we could spend that money to bring opportunity to our inner cities and our rural communities and our roads and our highways and bridges and schools. And what he really meant was all his rich white friends in the corrections industry. I'm obviously sick, heartsick, at all of this. It's super hard to watch this. Super hard to believe that this is happening. To look upon my countrymen and to think that a lot of them, certainly the Trump supporters, do not have a heart in their chest. So there was a press briefing about a month or two ago. And there was a reporter there from Time Magazine. And he was a kid. And he got to stand up and ask Sarah Huckabee Sanders a question. And what struck me about this was Sarah Huckabee Sanders seems to me like the coldest of cold. Does not care about anybody. Not brown folks, not children, not women, just cold. When this child stood up and asked her a question, it showed me that there's a little bit more to Sarah than I probably don't understand.
We recently had a lockdown drill. One thing that affects mine and other students' mental health is to worry about the fact that we or our friends could get shot at school. Specifically, can you tell me what the administration has done and will do to prevent these senseless tragedies?
I think that as a kid and certainly as a parent, there is nothing that could be more terrifying for a kid to go to school and not feel safe. So I'm sorry that you feel that way. This administration takes it seriously, and the School Safety Commission that the president convened is meeting this week, again, an official meeting, to discuss the best ways forward and how we can do every single thing within our power to protect kids in our schools and to make them feel safe and make their parents feel good about dropping them off.
She had no trouble lying to his face, but for a moment there, for a brief moment, you heard it even in her voice. You don't have to see the video. You can hear it in her voice. She starts welling up. She starts crying. I think when that child stood up and said that, she was there. She was there in the school watching children be shot or reaching out to protect children. Or maybe when that child stood up, maybe she saw one of her own children standing there. Now, her kids probably go to private school, but she likely saw one of her own kids standing there and said, oh, it's probably the first time she's ever questioned, what the F is she really doing? So much as I complain about these folks, conservatives and racists and all the rest, believe that it's just going to be harder for us to get to some people than to others. I saw a documentary recently where a Muslim woman was able to get interviews with dozens of people from the NSM, the Nationalist Socialist Movement, the white power movement in America. And they welcomed her in. They said, yeah, you can come in here. You can document. We're totally cool with that. We're not necessarily going to break bread with you, but we're going to let you in. She went to rallies with them. She got injured a few times, not from them, because the white nationalists would go up against Antifa. And she got to know them. She got to interview them. She got to be friends with some of them. And after that, by the time she put out the documentary, quite a few of those guys had decided to leave the movement because they met her. She spent time with them. She talked with them. She treated them like human beings. And she was able to get a few of them to leave that movement. Not by saying to them, you should leave this movement, but by being a Muslim woman right in front of them and showing that she cares about them, showing that she wants to hear from them, understand how they feel, understand how they think and why they think what they think. She really cared about them. She was just trying to get the story because she wanted all of us to see it. And forgive me, her name's escaping me right now. Oh, I'll bring it to you next week. When she did that, it just reminded me of other stories that I've read. I understand it's fun, the idea of punching Nazis, right? It's one of the most searched for terms in Oregon, Nazi punching. But as the head of Life After Hate, Christian, has always said, no one ever changed their mind when they got punched. They changed their mind after somebody showed some compassion towards them. And I know it's really hard with these people, and I'm not going to encourage you to just, you know, to go find somebody with a Trump shirt and hug them or whatever, because who knows, they might be packing, they might shoot you. But let's not shy away from these folks. There's a heart in there somewhere. Something happened in their life that made them feel alone, that made them feel hurt. Yeah, they love screaming at us that we are snowflakes. But when I hear that term, I hear little more than projection. It's exactly what I think of here, is nothing more than projection. It is they who are scared. It is they who are hurt. It is they who are left behind. It is they who are not loved. And now they found a community. They found a group within the white supremacist movement, and they've decided that this cause is now their cause. And they're not even really thinking about it. They're just doing it because they want to be a part of something, because they want to feel something, because they want to feel love. And it's not going to be easy with this group. The Confederate flags, the MAGA hats, the swastikas, it's really hard to associate with these people. But I think we need to. Because as much as I say, these people are cold and heartless and hateful, there's a heart in there somewhere. It's going to be really hard to get to, but we can get to it. I get frustrated on this show a lot, an awful lot. I'm sure you hear it. If I had a video camera in here, the show would probably be 10 times larger than it is, because I bounce off the walls inside this studio. And by the way, it's scorching hot in this studio. I've got AC in here, but I can't have it on because the mics will pick it up. But I want to close with this. The most frustrating thing for me is getting people to care about these issues. I feel like I'm appealing to people's basic humanity. And my frustration for this runs deep. So I read an article recently by Kayla Chadwick. The headline is, "I don't know how to explain to you that you should care about other people." Quoting here, "Like many Americans, I'm having politics fatigue. Or to be more specific, arguing about politics fatigue. I haven't run out of salient points or evidence for my political perspective, but there is a particularly stumbling block that I'm running into when trying to reach across the proverbial aisle to those and have those difficult conversations so smugly suggested by think piece after think piece. I don't know how to explain to someone that they should care about other people. Personally, I'm happy to pay an extra 4.3% for my fast food burger if it means the person making it can afford to feed their family. If you aren't willing to fork over an extra 17 cents for a Big Mac, you're fundamentally a different person than I am." This is, of course, against the people arguing against raising the minimum wage. "I'm perfectly content to pay taxes that go toward public schools, even though I'm childless and intend to stay that way, because all children deserve a quality education. If this seems unfair or unreasonable to you, then we're never going to see eye to eye. If I have to pay a little more with each paycheck to ensure my fellow Americans can seek access to health care, sign me up! Poverty should not be a death sentence in the richest country in the world. If you're okay with thousands of people dying of treatable diseases just so the wealthiest among us can hoard more wealth, there's a divide between my worldview and yours that will never be bridged. I don't know how to convince someone how to experience the basic human emotion of empathy. I cannot have one more conversation with someone who's content. They see millions of people suffer needlessly in exchange for a tax cut that statistically they'll never see. I cannot have political debates with these people. Our disagreement is not merely political, but a fundamental divide on what it means to live in a society or how to be a good person or why any of that matters. Frustration is just the beginning of it. This runs absolutely deep for me. And I know that this isn't going to be easy. But honestly, probably the best first step is to get the F off of social media. Start getting into things where you engage with other human beings. I engage with strangers on a daily basis. I cannot have any prejudices. It would make it impossible to do all of the jobs that I do, with the exception of this one. I suppose I could be in this room and scream into a microphone for an hour every week and not talk to other people, and that's just fine. But with the other jobs that I have, I cannot be a narrow-minded prick, because it would be impossible for me to do those jobs. And when you get out there and you start talking with more and more people, your fellow human beings, when you're behind a keyboard, it's pretty easy to dehumanize somebody when you're not face-to-face with them. Hell, the president has no problem doing that with his Twitter fingers. But when you're face-to-face with somebody, it's a hell of a lot harder. You tend to treat people more like a human being. So my suggestion to you, as hard as this is going to be, start finding those people. Start trying to engage with these people. Start treating them like human beings. And don't just start right off with that particular point. When you talk with somebody, talk about other things. Find common points. And if those really prickly subjects come up, just deal with them in a light fashion. Sort of move to the most basic points. You know, humanitarianism, love, family. Think about empathy. Think about your children. Things of that nature. Yeah, it's not always going to work, but for the times that it does work, it's absolutely going to be worth it. Thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Camp It Out. Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook.com. It's facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store, the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store or on Podbean. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, hate mail, or just a general statement or inquiry. You can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail. Rejecting austerity and Louis Gohmert in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Gavin for producing. Thank you for listening. This is Melvin signing off. And now that I've woken you up, good morning.